You're listening to a previously recorded episode of The Undercard, Hand Combat Radio.
This show is broadcasting live from Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming and is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Coming to you from the Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming, it's The Undercard, bringing you the best in hand combat coverage with feature interviews, major events, and the hottest ring girls from around the nation. The Undercard is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. And now, here they are, always in your corner, Brad, Marv, and Jimmy.
Welcome to The Undercard. It's officially episode 194. We're going to be talking a lot of boxing later on in the show. We're going to cover a little bit of UFC 200, which, Jimmy, I was thinking the other day before we introduce our guest and everything, probably the biggest event in mixed martial arts since the original UFC 1.
What is?
UFC 200.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely, yes.
So we got to start breaking that down because we're within 2 weeks of that happening. And we won't have enough time.
Yeah.
We won't have a lot of time to do that. And we got a special guest in studio with us. We have John Lepek. We're going to be welcoming him here in a few. He's more than welcome to chime in as we have to start the show off by talking Keith Thurman and Sean Porter. What a night for boxing. Premier Boxing Champions is financially hurting. Not only that, it was a fight that people who like boxing was excited about, and even the casual fan was excited about. You had Keith Thurman with a tremendous power, Sean Porter, a very likable guy. If you've ever met him, he's always smiling. And a lot of people were excited about this fight, but as John, with all his experience, can tell us later on, a lot of times that doesn't mean it's going to be a good fight.
I mean, come on, look at Mayweather-Pacquiao, you know?
That doesn't mean anything.
Exactly.
But what happened was when boxing kind of needed it, especially on CBS, not only on CBS, the Showtime announcers, they treated it. I don't know, Jimmy, because you watched it after the fact, but I watched it as it happened. They didn't do commercial breaks during the fight, so it was almost like you were watching it on Showtime. So you got the corners
and
stuff.
Oh, wow, okay.
They saved the commercials for before and after,
which
was amazing. They should do that all the time.
Yeah, I mean, because I was watching it at the replay afterwards, but I thought it was just something that they did as the replay, not what they did live. So that's very cool that they didn't go to commercial.
No, it was great. So let's just talk about the fight. We're not going to break it down too much because if you're a boxing fan, you've probably watched it a couple times. I kind of scored in my head. I give a round and then take a round away. I wasn't really writing it out, but I could have saw it being a draw. I could not see Sean Porter winning.
No.
I could see Keith Thurman winning, so I was very happy with the results.
Yeah.
Even if it was a draw, I was going to be okay with it. Keith Thurman... you know, for all the people that have more boxing background than me, say he landed cleaner shots. But you got to give Sean Porter a fight.
Yeah.
I mean, what a game plan, too.
Yeah.
Just to be always in his face, always. I mean, that's the way he fights.
Yeah.
But I thought Keith Thurman would be ready for that. I mean, he was literally grabbing him and throwing Thurman back into the ropes. It was very Rocky-ish when Drago did it.
It really was. There was a couple of times where it was something, I mean, you thought you were watching a movie because of the way that they slipped the jab, threw him into the corner or up against the ropes or you know, whatever. And Sean Porter, I mean, I've never seen a boxer currently that is just bull rushed right
down
into it.
You.
Yeah, head down straight into it. I mean, the last time I saw anybody, I think, do that was probably Tyson.
Did you put, like, Eye of the Tiger on or anything while you were watching
it? I didn't, but I should have. That would have,
And here you have Sean Porter, who was knocked down by Adrian Broner, a guy that I don't think anyone puts his power on the level of Thurman. And he was able to take Thurman's best shots.
Yeah.
There was some great photos of the shots that was he was taking. And then likewise, Thurman took Porter's best.
Mm-hmm.
Porter was landing some unbelievable shots. So all three judges, which is perfect. I didn't want any controversy here. Scored at 115 to 113, which seems about right. Like I said, I could have accepted a draw.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see Porter quite winning it. And this is great.
This was, in my opinion, if I may say.
Oh, yeah.
People always talk about styles make fights. But this was an example of where will and morale wins them. Not a lot of people speak about that. And I think you had two great game plans. And you have to give credit not only to Porter's father being in his corner, but the work of Dan Birmingham, a trainer that kind of gets forgotten about. But people forget about the great job that he did with Winky Wright all of those years, Jeff Lacey later on. And that was on display in Thurman's corner. And credit to both fighters for executing those game plans. So while Porter was the aggressor, as you said, kind of bull rushing, I wouldn't say with the elusiveness as a Tyson did. But then Thurman, surprising, you know, not standing in there and trading, but taking those half step backs, working the angles, you know, throwing the hooks, the uppercuts, and staying out of the way of those attacks. You have to give credit. And I want to say this. A lot of people were complaining, today's, we'll just call them cyber fans, for lack of a better term. But not every close fight merits controversy. My dear friend Mike Marley and I were speaking about this after the fight. It was a good fight. It was a close fight. I think you could say that it was an instant classic, if you will. Not a legendary fight, but an instant classic. One of the better ones PBC has put out, as you pointed out. But the argument could have been made either way. But there's no controversy in that. This was not a controversial fight. Both men deserve credit, and I think that the judges got it right.
Great background there, John. A question I wanted to ask you, too, and Showtime's commentators were right on the money with this. Here's Thurman and Porter. You stand them side by side, and for some reason Keith Thurman looks taller and looks like he has a longer reach. But really, when you measure it, he didn't. Mm-mm. That's kind of weird how different body types, the way Thurman fights it, you think he has the reach advantage, but when you measure it out, he doesn't. And it kind of worked that way through the fight too. It looked like Thurman had a couple more inches to counter with the left hook and stuff. It's interesting because when you do the measurements, it isn't there.
I say in boxing, you have to throw those measurements out the window. They're nice for the pre-fight tale of the tape, and they look good on graphics. But again, you had referenced Tyson. I mean, look at Mike. Mike was 5'11 and a half on a good day. But he was able to out-jab the great Tony Tucker, one of the forgotten heavyweights that came out of the Detroit area, who had a fantastic jab. He was able to out-jab Pinklin Thomas, Bone Crusher Smith. So I think those statistics, while sometimes they can play a part, I think you really have to throw them out the window again, because it's who wants it, who's going to bring it, and who's going to be able to overcome that when they're in the eye of the storm.
Now, this fight happened at the Barclays Center. We're going to talk about John's background here in a little bit, but while we're on the fight, I want to ask him. The Barclays Center is really giving Vegas a run for their money. Now Vegas has the new T-Mobile Bowl Arena, but it seems like the East is establishing himself again. You know, back in the early 80s, you're talking, or late 80s with Tyson, Atlantic City, Madison Square Gardens. But now the big fights that used to be at Madison Square Garden has moved to the top of the line in Brooklyn, the Barclays Center. Do you like fights on the East Side or West Side? Or what do you prefer, John, with all your experience?
We've done fights on each coast and many venues in between. I think if you're going to talk West Coast, though, you've got to talk about the old days at the Forum. I think the Staples Center is a great venue. We actually were part of the promotional team for Lennox's last fight, which kind of crowned Vitaly Klitschko as the new heir of the division at the time. Great fight crowd on the West Coast. Going into Vegas, I think that Vegas, from a business standpoint, will have the market cornered. And they will continue to do so because of all of the casinos there. I think going to the East Coast, though, sadly, Atlantic City is not what it once was. I did an article on the website that I work with, UCNLive.com, Undisputed Champion Network. Rest in peace, Damon Bingham. Very, very tragic incident we can speak about later with the Ali passing as well. But Atlantic City kind of lost the thunder, and Main Events was what a great company, great group of people, by the way, as well. Promoted some outstanding fights over the years there. Now, when you go up into New York, some classics through the years, as you pointed out, Madison Square Garden. And I think Barclays Center has given some promoters the right incentives, which, again, we talk about this as fans, but as we'll probably talk a little bit about later, the business, you've got to have a promoter-friendly venue in order to make these fights happen, because the taxes at the gate, it's tough for promoters to do business in these venues without the support of the casinos there.
Mm-hmm.
But a great venue.
Yeah, in Atlantic City, the city as a whole has gone down. So a lot of that is the reasoning behind them not attracting anything. But, you know, off the record, a good trainer friend of ours, he said that, you know, I asked him why a certain fight wasn't at Boardwalk Hall, you know, where a bigger venue. And he's like, who could draw that right now that wouldn't be in Vegas or wouldn't be in New York? And that's a good point. I mean, you know, Keith Thurman right away, too, speaking after the fight, instead of doing something stupid and calling out Mayweather, something that wouldn't happen anyways.
Right.
He went after Danny Garcia.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fight I think a boxing fan wants to see.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't declare, you know, let's do Porter 2 right away.
Right.
Danny Garcia, he wants his belt. Danny Garcia is a fighter that I think it's tough to say but needs that step up now. I mean, he's fighting at a top game, but it's like, okay, Now fight,
yeah,
Keith Thurman.
Right, yeah.
So I thought it was a really interesting call-out at the end of the fight. I mean, John, you coming from the background?
First, I think that, again, we've got to give a lot of credit, even post-fight, to both Porter and Thurman for conducting themselves as professionals and as champions. There wasn't any trash talk, and while both of them respectfully laid claim to why they felt they won the fight, I think they both conducted themselves as gentlemen after the fight. That being said, I think that would be a great fight. I think it would be a great matchup. I think Garcia, I want to be careful how I say this, but I think he kind of missed it. I think he had a lot of momentum coming after the Maidana fight. That was the Maidana, the one Argentina, and I forget... it was the big shootout he had, was Maidana, wasn't it?
I believe so. I can double check on BoxRec, though.
Sorry, I'm a little rusty here.
No, guys. It's okay. Hey, no
but
worries.
Yeah, he had a lot of momentum a couple years back, and then he went down to Puerto Rico. And I thought personally, while that was a nice move business-wise to maybe establish some more of the following from the homeland, Danny Garcia is from Philadelphia, and I thought it would have been better served. You spoke about Madison Square Garden or the Barclays Center. Now, that's where he should have moved to, and they should have made that his home. They should have tried to take over the weekend of the Puerto Rican Day Parade, which is historically a great fight weekend in New York, and they should have kept him busy. And even if it meant giving him some lesser opponents to kind of recover from that brutal war that he had taken part in, would have been better served, because right now I think inactivity works against him. I don't think he has improved since then, just if I may say so humbly. And I think right now I would give Porter or Thurman both the edge over Garcia at this point.
The fighter you were thinking of was Lucas Matisse.
Matisse, there you go. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Whew, you saved me. Thank God for Google.
And speaking of which, that fight Thurman versus Porter kind of reminded me of Matisse Provetnikov.
Mm.
In which just nobody was clinching. They both wanted each other. That's probably the last fight I remember where people were going head-to-head. And, you know, I walked away from the fight. That we were doing an MMA event at Eastern Market. I went to a bar to watch it because I even told Carlos, the promoter, I said, I can't miss it. And he told me, I understand. And he's like, tell me who wins. And so I went and I watched the fight because I wanted to watch it live. I didn't want to catch it later and kind of know the outcome. And when I came back, I told Jimmy it was one of the best fights I've seen.
Yeah,
I would agree.
It lived up to everything.
Surpassed.
So I'm very happy for this. And then now Sean Porter is in an interesting situation from a record standpoint. Is he going to be an A-list name? Probably not, but he's an enjoyable fighter. And he earned respect from people that are casually watch boxing. So it's going to be interesting to see where Sean Porter is. Now, the interesting thing is, could Porter do it again against Thurman, because I think if I had to pick a pony in the race, I'm always going to pick Thurman. I wonder if Porter could get it that close again. That's an interesting question. Did we see the best Sean Porter?
I think we saw the best Sean Porter, but I don't think we saw the best Thurman. I think Thurman's tactics, if he were to go against Porter again, would change dramatically, now having faced Porter. But I think Porter would probably end up doing almost the same thing that he's been doing, and the same thing that he did against Thurman. So I think we saw our best Porter, but we didn't see our best Thurman.
Very good takes.
Yeah, which speaks to my, you know, the talent. If this fight happens when it's originally supposed to happen, if Keith Thurman doesn't get in an accident and it delays it, which thank God it didn't affect any of the outcome of the fight. But if we do see a second fight, I would expect Thurman to maybe possibly, and I know after seeing Porter get lit up, mm-hmm. win by knockout, late mm-hmm. stoppage. Mm-hmm. I just think that the talent lies on Keith Thurman.
Yeah.
Now, just like Golovkin, just like any dangerous fighter, no one's going to want to fight Thurman. Now, calling out Danny Garcia doesn't mean Danny Garcia is going to be okay with it.
Right.
Because as John said, I think Danny Garcia has hit his glass ceiling.
Yeah.
I don't think he can, and it's tough because he's at the top of the game, but then there's that next 10 fighters.
Right.
The 10 best out there.
Right.
And that Danny Garcia isn't in my top 10. But Keith Thurman is.
This is where we've got to talk about this, though, gentlemen, and let's not avoid the truth, because that's what the sweet science is the truth. And are you in this business to protect your record, or do you want to become great?
Right.
Because Thomas Hearns' greatness, and he was a great fighter, was established sometimes when he had to come back from the brink of destruction. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about devastating losses, knockout losses, like against Marvelous Marvin Hagler, but came back and fought James Shuler, who was an undefeated fighter with a couple hundred amateur fights, trained by the great late Eddie Futch, who was no opponent. This was no give-me fight. And to come back and return to the place where he lost against Hagler on Hagler's undercard, mm-hmm. when he fought Mugabe, and knock out in devastating fashion a fighter like James Shuler in the first round, that's how you come back and prove and establish greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And I get really tired of a lot of these guys today. Like, used to be the old classic, well, I'll fight him, but give me a tune-up first. No, let's get down.
Right.
This is what you do. Let's do it.
Right. Yeah, no, I think there's a lot, and this goes on both sides of boxing and MMA, but there are way too many guys out there that are trying to protect the O. They're not taking the big fights. They're not, you know, we said when we were talking a lot about Floyd Mayweather that in order to be the greatest, you got to take the challenging fights, the fights where you're probably going to end up losing, but don't lose.
Well, it's said.
whether it's actually there or not. When you speak of Floyd Mayweather,
mm-hmm.
there will always be an asterisk.
Yes, exactly. Mm.
It may not it's not actually be there on paper. But whenever you speak of him, it's like he was 49-0. But I mean, look at who he fought.
Right.
You know that's always going to be there when people say that.
But
there's not an asterisk when you say Muhammad Ali was the greatest.
Right.
But look at who he fought.
But look at
exactly.
John can speak of this too, because he's friends with a lot of people that he's talking about back in the day. But look at how Floyd Mayweather's probably going to still be in 20 years. And if he doesn't take another fight, doesn't take any damage, he's going to walk away from the game a lot healthier than a lot of these fighters.
Sure.
Very rich. And at that point,
if
you're considered in the top 10,
that's fine.
He's got to learn to live with that.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, that's fine, but
no one's
going to
put him
in
the top five.
Right.
But if you can live in the top 10.
He's got to be able to live
with
that.
And that's
what I don't think he can. And I don't think you've seen the best.
But there's nobody out there that he can beat that's going to – you're going to put him ahead of the greats.
Right.
Guys, it's the crowd. It's the cheer of the crowd.
Oh, of course it is. And it's the big, you know –
it's the ego.
Big old dollar sign.
Probably will need the money in 5 years.
Well, that's – yeah.
I think Mayweather has a big enough ego to – no matter where people rank him, he'll just – in his own mind say, well, I'm the best.
Yeah, but the face of boxing, I mean, it's changed from when Muhammad Ali was fighting, too. I mean, now it's like the flash of it.
Mm-hmm. The flash has always been there. I think that it's just...
It's more prominent.
It's more prominent due to a lot of the outside elements, such as social media.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, could you imagine if there was Facebook and Twitter when Muhammad Ali fought Joe Frazier?
Oh, my God. The Twitter spurs would be
exploding. From Ali.
I would, yeah, exactly.
Right? Like, I would give my left anything to have had that, right?
You know? No, I mean, seriously, like Ali would have been all over Twitter and all over Frazier.
Oh, he would have been all over Instagram.
What
like,
a great thought.
He would have been Facebook Live-ing
exactly.
Ambushed Frazier's camp. I'm at Frazier's camp right now.
Yeah, and he would have been doing the live, and he would have been doing his poems. He would have been YouTubing all of his poems.
He would have been a huge YouTuber.
Oh, huge.
His YouTube,
his own channel.
He would have billions of views on YouTube.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. He may even have. He may have even had his own. Like his own social media platform.
Probably, yeah.
Now, we got to talk about this before we move on to our main interview here with John. So Kovalev and Andre Ward started off something very interesting in which they kind of had a fight and then they put it in paper, but there was going to be fights up to it. And now it appears from a lot of legit sources that Golovkin and Canelo have the same principle, but it's a year and a half away.
Right.
I'm kind of mixed on this. One, I'm glad, because then it's not like Pacquiao Mayweather where you're just kind of anticipating it. So maybe there's some document somewhere that Golovkin and Canelo has said this.
Right.
But year and a half wait, and I think both are ready.
Oh, they're not
but
doing
it'll give
it.
Me time
single
to save
to...
up so I can go.
No, they're going
to
really? A year from September.
Really? Wow,
a year from September.
I honestly expected them to do it in Cinco de Mayo, but
a year from September. So
you have both Mexican holidays, if you will.
Yes,
you got
one in September too.
Which is what?
Forget it. But Mayweather,
Yom
was
Kippur,
controlling
I think.
No, I can't remember.
Shalom.
Show this.
You put me on the spot again.
You'll have to look up.
I want to look it up
you
right
said
now.
It.
Cinco de Mayo and
is it
Cinco de September?
Is it the Day of Dead One? The
no,
day?
No,
no, that's
But Mayweather.
Oh, it's the Mexican
Independence Day.
Yes, Day.
Thank you.
September 16th.
Yes. And as John said, Mayweather made those were his weekends.
I thought that was
He took them
Cinco
over.
De Mayo.
You know, back in my day, and I was fortunate enough when the late, great Emmanuel Stewart had brought me to my first non-Kronk training camp was with the great Julio Cesar Chavez.
Nice.
And, gosh, what a great experience that was. Chavez, a lot of people think Tyson was my favorite, but it was Chavez. And to go to Mexico where he truly was a god. It's hard for people to explain just how big he was. And he made those weekends in Vegas really something special. And then when Oscar came along, and then you had Vargas. Mayweather, which is an interesting subject you pointed out about being the face of boxing, I like to say he was kind of chosen because there really wasn't anyone there at the time when Oscar was fading out. You know, Oscar, he had star power. If we look back, Mayweather was not a pay-per-view draw.
Mm-mm.
Mayweather was not a superstar in that regard. He was undefeated. He could be shaped and molded, if you will. And to this day, I still don't think that he really took it from Oscar that night. I was there.
Yeah. So, you know, how there's before BC and then, you know, kind of that's the same way with – I'm talking years, but the same way with Mayweather as you're talking. There's Pretty Boy Floyd up until the Oscar De La Hoya fight, and then there's Money Floyd, which was a totally different fighter. Kind of invented himself.
He made
a lifestyle and made himself a draw. So that's, I guess, good news about Golovkin and Canelo, the other two superstars. But the bad thing about it is Golovkin is much older than Canelo. And I believe Canelo and Golovkin are probably ready for each other. They're just going to make us wait, and there's going to be a couple fights. Canelo's already announced his September fight. Pardon me, I forgot the name. But
there's a good point. You forget the name. See, I don't think that it's Golovkin that's avoiding Canelo by any stretch of the means. I know Golovkin's promoter very well, a dear friend of mine, Tom Loeffler. who started out years ago with Harlan Warner. They used to manage Sugar Shane Mosley, some other fighters going way back, Obakar at the end of his career. Tom is a deal maker, okay? Tom, I can assure you, was on the phone looking to make that deal. Golovkin is ready to go. It's not his fault that he can't get a guy in front of him, whether it's because PBC has got all these guys locked up and they want to dance around, go around their own little merry-go-round and not play ball with other promoters. You know, he's there. I think Canelo, this is where we get into the business. And shame on Oscar. You know, I'm sorry, but you should know what Canelo means to the people of Mexico. And can you imagine what a disrespect? The WBC, an organization that is deeply rooted in the history of the legendary fighters from Mexico, an organization that's based out of Mexico, and for Canelo to give up that title and not face Golovkin, that's business.
Mm-hmm.
They're worried.
Yeah.
Interesting. He's fighting Liam Smith.
That's right.
Yep.
Who?
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk. You mentioned Emmanuel. I mean, obviously a legend in boxing, but especially around Detroit with the development of fighters. And off the record, one of his close friends, when I was writing the article for the last fight that I wrote, leaned over to me and he said, "This is where we really miss Emmanuel." And he was talking about the development of the fighters from the 3-0 mark to about the 10-0 mark, the 15-0 mark, and the way Emmanuel had a magic of bringing them up, getting them competition, getting them noticed. Because there's a lot of fighters out there right now in the Michigan area that are in that little time zone. They're proteges of Emmanuel and Kronk, and they're fighting a lot of fighters on these local shows that might not be the steps up they should be taking to develop their career. Tony Harrison, the leader of the pack, because he is now fighting in an IBF title eliminator fight, mm-hmm. June 30th.
July 30th,
yeah. We're already in June. But July 30th has found a way to do that. And that's great. But as John will tell you, the business side, there is a skill to it. And Emmanuel was really good at it. He was going to give you a fight that would develop you, and you'd move on. It's tough for me to say this about some of the fights I'm seeing the local fighters seeing, but they're not developmental fights. They're not fights they need right now. And if you look bad in these fights, it's hurts your stock.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not only does it hurt your stock, you're going to get hurt down the road.
Yeah.
Because you're going to fight somebody that had those developmental fights, mm-hmm. and you're going to be lost. John, you want to speak a little bit about what Emmanuel was so good about doing that? And there is a void right now.
There is so much to be said about that. First, Emmanuel, God, we were all so blessed and fortunate to have had someone like Emmanuel Stewart in our city, because he meant so much to boxing. And one thing that should also be said is that Emmanuel had a very good support staff and support system around him, with the late Walter Smith, Luther Burgess, Sammy Poe, Floyd Logan handling the amateur kids, and then with my mentor, Bill Kozerski, on the promotional side, and then Tom Vaca. As you spoke about matchmaking, Tom Vaca is one of the greatest matchmakers I've ever seen. Now, Emmanuel understood a little bit of each particular, let's say, piece to that puzzle, but he focused on what he did, and that was train the fighter. But he knew that you had to take those developmental fights. Maybe one fight, you take that guy again, he's 3-0. But this time you fight a guy, he's got a really good jab, but he doesn't have a good right hand. The next time you match him against a guy that's got a good right hand, but he may not have as good as a jab. You pick a guy with good legs. Next time you pick a guy that's a little more flat-footed. In each fight, again, this is what you do. You have to know your opposition, and you have to know your fighter. So each fight, you should be learning something. You made a great point. This will come back to haunt you down the road. And as my friend Tariq Salmasi always, he says, a great saying, the cream always rises to the top.
Yeah. I mean, you want to see it in your developmental phase, and you're talking about – that's a great observation, what I was saying about Emmanuel, the developmental fights. Fight somebody with a good jab. Fight somebody that can get you the rounds. Fight somebody that won't go down. You know, you should have a checklist, almost a bingo thing, in the first 10 fights. I want to get somebody that's giving me my first southpaw, everything I want to see.
There you go.
And so that when I'm 20-0, I'm not stepping in the ring with somebody that's had that development and is a little bit ahead of me. Okay, you know, so I might be the more talented guy, but he's seen a little bit more of the ring.
What about the guys who you ask him, like, do you know anything about the guy you're fighting? No, I don't care. I'm not even – I haven't even watched any tape on him.
Well, today it was easier to say that and get away with it back in our day. You actually had to order VHS tapes.
Right.
And you could cross-reference a record. You could make a call to not just Emmanuel Stewart, but we're missing guys like Johnny Boz.
Yeah.
You know, somebody could call who would talk to you till the sun came up, and you'd come back, you know, from breakfast, and he'd still be on the phone talking, literally. And these are guys, Don Majeski, there's some of them are still around, that could actually tell you about the fighters. Today, not a lot of people really want to do that because it sounds cool in some cases. And in some cases, they just don't care because they don't understand. And this is where we had talked about on the lobby prior to the show beginning, was the mentoring aspect. And that's another thing that Emmanuel did so well. See, a good trainer, he never stops learning. He's a good listener. Emmanuel had great patience. He had respect for his fighters. He was dedicated to boxing. He wasn't out given personal training lessons and promoting one night, trying to fight the next night. He's an MMA fighter on Saturday, a boxer on Tuesday. He was a trainer and a damn good one. He led by example. He had a passion. He understood the importance of the fundamentals, the mechanics, and he was a part psychologist, and I could go on and on. But, you know, the one thing I'll leave you with was he was such a master, not only to watch in the gym, but to watch him in the corner, and having been privileged enough to be with him in the corner on a few occasions, he knew what buttons to push. He knew how to get in that fighter's head and bring that fighter back. Like when Milton McCrory was in against Colin Jones in a 100-plus degree heat outside in Las Vegas, he pushed Milton's buttons and got Milton to come back. When Tommy Hearns was hurt by Leonard in the rematch, Emmanuel knew what buttons to push in the corner. Emmanuel even knew how to rub certain muscles in the neck after Tommy got rocked to help him recover in between rounds. These are just some of the things that made Emmanuel great.
Yeah, so we're being joined by John Lepek this show. We're going to talk about his background because he has a fascinating background here in a second. We're going to go to our first break, and we also got Ring Girl Cassie here. We're going to cover some other stuff later on, UFC 200. So thank you for listening to The Undercard, episode 194. We'll be back in a few moments.
You're listening to a previously recorded episode of The Undercard, Hand Combat Radio.
Welcome back to The Undercard, episode 194. We are joined by John Lepek. We are going to get into his background right now. Former original Kronk Gym member and promoter with Michigan's longest and most successful promotional company, Fight Night Incorporated. We were just talking out in the hallway, John. How many years was it? It ran 16?
18 years at the Palace.
Jeez.
And prior to that, a lot of people forget that it was Bill who was the original promoter back throughout the 80s at the original Little Caesars fights down at Cobo, all the big fights down at the Joe. He was a young man fresh out of dental school, and his sister was actually working for Mike Ilitch at the time. And a couple gentlemen, Sam Lafato, Ron Moore, a few Emmanuel had a nucleus back then of guys who helped Prentice Bird. They kind of were the financial guys early on in getting Tommy there for the first Leonard fight was the first big score, if you will. And then after that, Emmanuel and Bill had a discussion, and he had stepped in and became the official promoter. So if you've seen Ringside, or I think it was Gold Circle was another name, those were all Bill's entities.
That's a perfect example of vertical integration. If you have a dental degree, you You want to invest in sports like hockey and boxing.
Oh no. Don't invest in boxing.
No. And as he was just saying, you don't invest in boxing. So here's the thing about boxing that everybody should know. It's not a dark secret. It takes a lot of time to make money, if you eventually even do make money. And it's a lot of years of commitment. You got to love the sport. And you got to be willing to take a lot of losses. And you hope for that one payday. Then you start over again with somebody. Tell us about some of the experiences over all those years as you guys are developing.
Well, you know, you touched on a couple of very good points that they seem to be common sense, but common sense is not so common in boxing, because people come into this business as fans, and that is mistake number one. This is a business, and it is a very tricky business, as you said. And not only does it take a lot of time to hopefully make money, but it takes a lot of money to be invested. I'll tell you, one of the things that I'll share was the greatest piece of advice that I ever heard given was by our matchmaker, Tom Vaca. He said, if you want to get in this business, you're better off buying yourself a ringside ticket, a first-class flight ticket, and a hotel suite to every fight that you ever want to go to, because you'll come out ahead at the end of the day. And let me tell you, there's a lot of guys around here, they might not want to admit it, but I think they'd be further ahead had they heard that advice. I'll say this to begin. There's no barrier to entry to this. Anyone can get in it, whether you're a dentist or a car salesman or, you know, a guy that was sitting ringside. If you've got some money to spend, there's someone there that'll take it. And to develop fighters, you also have to develop a program, because the program must continue. You made an interesting point about developing the one guy to hopefully develop the next. You've got to develop a group of guys, and no one guy can be bigger than the program. The program has to be able to have longevity. And Bill, and I always refer this to Bill, because please, I was fortunate enough to just be a fly on the wall as a kid and found my niche, but I owe it to all to people like him. And Bill, as he used to say, caught lightning in a bottle twice. By having two heavyweight champions of the world, Michael Moore, who he did very well with, and Chris Burt. Mm-hmm. The program developed, as I was saying, from the early days with the Kronk organization, and then when the Palace had opened up, I think it was 88, with Big George Foreman and a man who transitioned from fighter to promoter, Bobby Hitz in Chicago. Shout out to my man, Bobby.
His shows are awesome in Chicago.
He's a good man.
Blackjack when watching boxing.
He's a good man. And Bobby fought George Foreman that night. And then Bill and Emmanuel parted ways. And if you look at that point, I'm just talking facts here. That was pretty much it from Kronk as far as their promotions went. You kind of had the dismantling of what Emmanuel would refer to as the class of 88 with Gerald, as we were speaking of in between great break. Great fighter, Gerald McClellan. You had Leonzer Barber. You had Oba Carr, Michael Moore, Jesse Benavidez. The list goes on. But that was the last real class of the original Kronk group. Now, Michael stayed with Bill, and the Davamos brothers out of Florida handled his management at that point. Emmanuel was bought out. But then Jackie Callen, who had split from being the PR person for Emmanuel for all those years, was managing James Toney. She kind of caught lightning in a bottle when James knocked out Michael Nunn. And then Jackie formed the Galaxy Boxing Team. And the Fight Night at the Palace program kept rolling right along. And Jackie brought in this whole new class of fighters. A young Tariq Salmassi, Leo Nolan, Bronco McCart, another one. Some really good guys that are still around the sport today doing different things. Scotty Buck, you know, I love Scotty.
Scotty's awesome.
Great, great guy, man. I love him. Bernard Harris, so many others. And Lonnie Beasley, Tom Boom Boom Johnson. And James came back and fought at the Palace a few times. But, I mean, think about it. Guys like a young Bronco McCart. We didn't ask Bronco to go out and sell tickets. I was on social media on the way here, and I see these guys that are selling tickets. Are you kidding me? Fighter's job is to fight. The fighter's job is to go to the gym, he trains, and he gets ready to do one thing, that's fight, not sell tickets. Okay, people need to look up the definition of promoter in Webster's dictionary, and that's to promote, okay? Not the fighter's job. So you looked at Bronco, what he was able to do is because he focused on his career. Now you look at Tim Denby, some of the names he fought coming up, that's what got him ready to fight Aaron Davis for the title, okay? Bronco ducked no one. Bronco was an overachiever. Mm-hmm. What a great, if people want to look at a role model, now there's a guy they should look at. There's the real hard work dedication is my man Bronco McCart. You look at another fighter we developed, Rico Hoy was one of the last fighters I had the privilege of working with. It wasn't, I would call, protective matchmaking. It was strategic against veterans like Kenny Snow, Greg Wright, who was never a fight night fighter, but he made great matches. Greg, you knew if you called him, he was going to take on whoever they put in front of him, the Stevenson twins. He was there. So it was time for us. We needed a veteran for Rico to fight when he was maybe 8-9-0. So he fought, Greg, guys like that. And so that's how Rico got prepared to, again, another fight night fighter, fought for the world title. I don't even know the last time we've had a guy in Detroit other than K-9 who's fought for the world title. And let's be honest, how did he get that shot? Because of contender fame.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't because of what he was able to achieve locally on promotions.
So I got a question for you, John. Can it happen what you were saying where people roll these fighters up? Could it happen nowadays with the way that boxing is in Michigan? Because I know you're still in the game even though you're away from the game. Could you even do that? Because it is a little different in the landscape. And
I'm
then
not
you're talking
gonna
about
it.
Right, exactly. But could it be done?
Of course it can be done. We don't have to reinvent the wheel here. Somebody's got to come back in it. It's kind of like the complexities, if you will, in the school district that plagues the school district. It's the students that are kind of running the show. You know, somebody has to step back in, as you so eloquently put it in the lobby prior to the show, is it needs leadership. And you need a matchmaker. You need a promoter. You need a team. And you've got to have managers. You've got to have real trainers. Again, the people that specialize in what they do so the fighters can fight. And you're not going to tell us at the Palace, well, I'm not going to fight him, or I don't want to fight that. Well, then you're not fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what? We're not going to continue to put guys like that on our shows and let them dictate to us how we do business. But at the same time, professionally speaking, we're not going to ask anything of them other than just show up and fight.
Very well put. I mean, it's amazing because you're talking about a time frame that isn't too far. It's not too far away. I mean, we're talking. I remember the fight nights at the Palace. I mean, that was some of the earlier experiences with boxing were those nights. And if you look on a calendar, not too far away, but a long time away still.
That's very interesting. And wow. You left me speechless. You hit me with a good one, too, right there, if you will. It does seem like light years ago, but then again, it seems like yesterday. But, you know, take a look at a young man we were talking about, Scotty. I really am a fan of his because he took on anyone that you called him to fight. Now, Scotty is a perfect example to use in today's business model. Now, if Scotty Buck was fighting today, he would be the young, undefeated Jewish sensation from West Bloomfield, Michigan, who was counted on by the promoters to sell $4,000 or $5,000 tickets, you know, or $4,000 or $5,000 tables of 10 every time there was a fight, and they would be bringing him back with cannon fodder every time, as Tom and Bill used to say, or a tomato can, if you will. And you know, that's just not the way you build a program or you build a fighter. You know, instead, Scotty Buck, He fought all comers, and sure he had some losses, but if you will pardon my language, but you know, Scotty fought with nuts and guts. You know, he put it on the line, and that's why he got called back to always get a fight, because he brought it every single time. Now the guy who tried to dictate and say, "Oh, I don't want to fight him," guess what? Tom Vaca stopped calling him.
Wow, man, it was like 15, 16 years ago. So different now. You're talking about Scotty Buck, but let's talk Cotty and some of the other people you were around.
My man.
A lot of spirit. I mean, magical time, if you think about it. I mean, everyone's always going to talk about the late 70s, early 80s with Detroit boxing. And, you know, that's the glory years. But for someone younger like me, 38, the glory years were the fights you're talking about. Bronco McCart fighting at the Palace. And those are the ones that I can remember. I mean, I saw Hearns fight at Joe Louis Arena, the final hit, you know, which wasn't his final, where he rolled the ankle.
Yeah, I helped on that show. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was my first experience seeing Tommy fight. And so, you know, for the younger generation, these names that I'm mentioning, these are people we remember.
You know, I was fortunate enough to be able to ride my bike to the Kronk Gym as a kid growing up over on Michigan Avenue, and was just a fly on the wall. And then when I got out of high school, I was able to come back down to the gym, and as you said, you know, be a member there. I wasn't 1% to 10% of the guys that I trained around. Although Walter Smith praised me as the greatest shadow boxer in the gym,
that's awesome.
That's about it. Yeah, it was, considering my company. But you spoke of Cotty. You know, my big brother. He's truly the uncle to my children. I was so honored when he asked me to help guide his career along with his attorney, Gene Hunt, great man who's running for judge right now in Dearborn. You couldn't ask for a better man. The citizens of Dearborn, listen up, Gene Hunt. And Sterling McPherson, who was Don King's right-hand man for so many years when he broke away from working with Don, and then we went to work with Tyson and so many other fighters. This was the team I brought in with Cotty. But again, I brought in a team. Frank Warren is the promoter. That's why he got the shot at Mitchell Chesky. Now, let's segue back into what you were saying of that generation, the late 80s, early 90s. You realize when you walked into the Kronk Gym in that time frame, and Cotty was a light heavyweight coming up. Now, Cotty didn't need, there's no secret, Cotty didn't need to box back then. Cotty was financially well-to-do when he was a young man. We'll leave it at that. But we had Thomas Hearns, Michael Moore, Leonzer Barber, Dennis Andres. These are four men that held world championships in the light heavyweight division within, what, maybe a 12-month span? That WBO title went from Michael, when he moved to heavyweight. Leonzer fought for the title. And again, you look at the local fights. Leonzer against Anthony Hembrick at the Palace. You guys didn't duck each other. You fought. There's a local rivalry. Let's get it on. You know, and then when Leonzer lost the belt to Mitchell Chesky in Germany, even though we didn't wear the gold trunks, as I had said to our team was, we still trained in Kronk every day with Walter Smith. When we went to Vegas for camp, we brought in Stacy McKinley, who was training Mike at the time. Stacy cut his teeth in the Kronk gym, training Gerald years earlier. We went to bring that belt back home to Detroit. Now, back underneath those four great fighters, you had Cotty, who was a young man. You had, going into some similar close weight classes to get work, you had Jeff Thompson, you had Tony Clark, you had Gerald McClellan, Fabian Williams, Frankie Lyles. There's so many others I probably are slipping my mind right now. That's just all in the span of 1 to 2 weight classes. This was the gym work.
It's freaking phenomenal. I mean, we're going to keep John around because his knowledge is absolutely fantastic. He's got some good stories about Tyson. Going to talk about Muhammad Ali. Anthony Barnes has joined us. Hey. Come on, Anthony.
We were speculating.
Remember where the microphone is.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's been a while.
We were speculating that since you drive an old man car now that maybe you know, started driving
this,
like
is
an
is this
old
your
man.
Way of announcing your retirement? Because it is a retirement car.
You know, I was like, all right, keep a Camaro. Like get pulled over all the time. Get like a low key Cadillac, like an old man. Not even get looked at. And I haven't got pulled over yet, so it's perfect.
Nice keeping it Detroit. He's riding slow.
It might also be the fact that it has a some kind of a, what'd you call it?
Yeah, I said like the it has a regulator on it, like the Tesla has the insane mode. I assume the Cadillac has the don't go over 35 mode.
So that's why you don't.
That's why you haven't got that ticket. Yeah,
because you can't get. Yeah,
but it is Anthony's birthday. Yeah. He ignored us last week, but we did get him something from his favorite bakery in Royal Oak.
Too bad you're training and can't eat that.
Jimmy's got to do what's on tap. Yep. We'll be back after what's on tap. A couple couple songs, and then we're going to be back with John, Cassie Ringgirl, and Anthony Barnes has joined us. We'll be back.
All right. So once again, this is What's On Tap, sponsored by Falling Down Beer Company. All right. You'll have to excuse me for a little bit. My printer broke down, so I don't have the sheets. I'm doing this right off the line. So starting off with boxing, June 28th at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, PBC on Fox Sports 1. Edner Cherry versus Lydell Rhodes, 10 rounds for the lightweights. At Tepic, Mexico, we have Jose Argumendio versus Julio Mendoza, 12 rounds for Argumendio's IBF strawweight title. At Khon Kaen in Thailand, we have Brian Rios versus knockout CP Freshmart, 12 rounds for Rojas' WBA strawweight title. June 30th in Connecticut, we have Luis Rosa versus Luis Hinojosa, 8 rounds for the junior featherweights. I'm going to read all of the fighters on this, Marv, because your favorite fighter shows up on here numerous times. Yes. Next, we have Jennifer Salinas versus Gina Shamil, 8 rounds. We have Noel Murphy versus Afram Mima, 6 rounds for the junior welterweights. Mm-hmm. And fighting 4 times in the same night, we have Mikey Williams versus TBA.
Oh,
Charles Foster versus TBA.
Oh, there he is again.
William Foster III versus TBA.
How does he do it?
I don't know. And Irvin Gonzalez versus TBA.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. It's a big night for TBA.
You know, if anybody can do it, it's that warrior.
I know. I know. I mean, absolutely. July 1st at Los Angeles, we have Oscar Negrete versus Jose Bustos, 10 rounds for the bantamweights, Mexico City, Telemundo. We have Carlos Ruiz versus Sebastian Diaz, 10 rounds for the junior lightweights. July 2nd, Reading, Pennsylvania, PBC and ESPN, we have Denise Shafikov versus Yamel Herring, 10 rounds for the lightweights. In Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, we have Zulina Menoz versus Lorena Taborda, 10 rounds for the female junior bantamweights. Longmont, Colorado, we have Inocente Fiez versus Arturo Crispin, 8 rounds for the junior middleweights. Mexico City, Mexico, we have Gangian Lopez versus Jonathan Taconing, 12 rounds for Lopez's WBC junior flyweight title. And July 3rd in Germany, we have Erkan Tepper versus Derek Rossi, 10 rounds for the heavyweights. Moving on to MMA, on June 28th, we have PBC and FS1, Sherry versus Rhodes. July 1st, we have LFC 57, Legacy Fighting Championship 57, Diamond Jack's Casino in Louisiana. July 2nd, we have ONE Championship, Dynasty of Champions in China. We have Road FC 32, Road Fighting Championship 32 in Hunan, China. We also have Nuaz Combat 5 in Accra, Brazil. We have, on July 3rd, we have Shutu Gig West 18 in Osaka, Japan. July 3rd, we have Deep Satyama Impact in Kodeo Kawago, 2016 in Japan.
Kawago.
Yeah. We have July 3rd, Brave Fights 13 in Japan. We have Tough and Off. 2016 IMMAF World Championships Day 1 in Las Vegas, Nevada. And once again, that's What's On Tap, sponsored by Falling Down Beer Company. We're going to go to a couple songs, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to a previously recorded episode of The Undercard, Hand Combat Radio.
Welcome back to The Undercard, episode 194. We have a great conversation going on with John Lepek, originally from – oh, my mic is going out. Why is my mic doing that? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, just fine.
Then it's the headphones, actually. Yeah, my headphones are going in and out. But
you're fine.
We were talking very early in the show about the Thurman-Porter fight, but something that happened on the undercard, and I'm going to start lobbying for this. Get women's boxing on TV, okay? It deserves a fair shot. Heather Hardy won against Christy Simmons on the undercard of the Barclays Center. She is basically the Brooklyn kid fighting out Gleason's gym. A mutual friend of ours that we met through Dimitri Salida, who hangs around Gleason's gym. She's great for the sport. I'd like to see Heather Hardy and, you know, get some TV time. So we're going to start lobbying for that. Get her some TV time. There she's only 17-0 now.
Yeah, you know.
All right. It's signed by Under Armour, is it? Or you know I forget what? Her sponsorship. Dates.
Call me when she's 22-0.
22-0? Right. You're that guy, huh? Yeah. It's got to be 20-0, 20-0. Yeah.
Most women don't even make it to 17 in anything. You know what I mean? Like,
no, we don't, Barnes. Yeah. What?
What?
No, I mean, like, inhale it? Yeah, I totally ate that.
This week's sexist comment brought to you.
No. I mean, listen.
By the campaign to elect Donald Trump president.
Listen. Do you know how hard it is for women to get fights? I mean, you know. It's crazy, let alone her be 17.
It depends. Are they dating R. Kelly?
Wow.
That's low.
Or Floyd.
Or Floyd. Yeah, are they dating Floyd?
Oh,
yeah.
But
can't go any lower.
Oh, yes, it can.
Who's the other guy? Rice, or not Rice. Who's the other guy?
Turner?
Ike Turner, yeah.
She definitely needs TV time, though. Yeah. You know, like 17-0 is absolutely, no, that's incredible for, you know, any males to get there.
Yeah.
And let alone, because we have so many professional male boxers. Female fighters, there's not that many. So get to that point is absolutely incredible.
You know, to touch base and stay on the topic, I agree, especially if she's got the hometown following and she can back it up. We promoted locally great fighter and a great person, Mary Jo Sanders, throughout her career. She had a very solid manager, and Jimmy Mallow did a great job. You know, Jimmy, to kind of touch on that business part, Jimmy brought in the sponsors and handled the ticket sales and handled all of the business that was needed to. We focused on the promotion. She focused on the training and fighting. And one night in particular, we promoted a show up in it wasn't Soaring Eagle. It was another casino. Mr. Garza, I think, helped build the bridge there, if I'm not mistaken. And it was a Showtime fight, and she stole the show to the point where Monday morning, her father, the late, great Charlie Sanders, they had played the fight film in the Lions practice meeting Monday morning, and it stole the show in the practice meeting. It was one of Mary Jo's greatest fights, and I had the... Again, I hate to use it over and over, but the honor and the privilege of working with Layla Ali in her third fight. I brought her here to Detroit. We did a fight downtown. Cotty and her were the co-main events. Brought her back to the Casino Windsor when I held a gaming license there to promote. We spoke about Tommy's last stand there when Terry Lockhart, may he rest in peace, and Emmanuel wanted her to come on board, and I had brought her back for that. Then when we did the Tyson-Galata fight, it was a natural for me to kind of be the one to reach out to Damon, who I spoke about earlier, and bring her back for that. So I had a lot of experience in working, at least with those two females. And I'll tell you, in more times than not, not only did they save the show, they stole the show.
Yep.
They were the show. I agree.
Yeah, I asked this question. I probably asked this question like 3 or 4 times because we've had people that have involved with Tyson and Galata. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people that made that fight happen. But what odds would you give me if I said, who's going to cause more problems for you that week, Mike Tyson or Andrew Galata? What would have my odds been on Galata?
Oh, it was going 50-50. Well, now that's a different story. Now, I can. You asked if I had some interesting stories, and if you... If I may.
Oh, yeah. I was at Tyson Galata, and I don't know if you know this story, but I could only afford the cheap seats, okay?
Okay.
But what happened is Showtime. Well, no. Showtime, mid fight, they had people going up to the upper deck because at that time the lower bowl hadn't filled in, and they wanted it filled for Showtime. Yeah. And I'll have to send a picture of my ticket stub, but I was only like 6 or 5 rows back. We were upgraded.
Oh,
just
wow.
The whole, they were just handing them out just to make sure. So, like, I was really close to it. Wow. And then the chaos that ensued with the Galata at the end. But I love talking this fight because I was there. So let's talk it, you know?
That's an interesting story how they came about. Now, we weren't involved in certain parts of that deal. Thomas Hearns and his group wanted to bring the fight. And at that time, the promotional group, or the handlers, I should say, were looking for a site fee. And this was at least one that, you know, had a chance to do good at the box office, unlike a lot of these, you know, C-name fighters that you'd never heard of. They're looking for, you know, astronomical amounts of money, and the fight means nothing. Well, Tyson and Galata meant something. That was an interesting fight. So what happened was every other entity involved in the fight contacted Fight Night and said, you know, Bill, we want you to basically handle this from A to Z. So going into the fight, I had to actually prepare, I'm going to date myself, a VHS tape back then, of all of the different ways to have a ring walk, to have security posted up in the corners. This was a huge security meeting. Next to Tyson Lewis, this was the biggest security meeting I was ever in at the palace. So we had all these different groups of law enforcement. We had a lot of off-duty DPD members. They used to be actually Michael Moore security, Wick, and some of the boys. And one group was with Galata, one group was with Tyson. And Mike was in an interesting mood, to put it mildly, that week. Yeah. And as the post-fight drug test would confirm, he kind of chilled out a little bit the night before the fight. He
tested positive for marijuana.
As it goes. And Galata, this is where it gets interesting. Now, Galata was being promoted by Main Events at the time. And Main Events and Bill were partners with a few fighters over the years. And at the time, I think they were still partners with Chris Bird and Fight Night. Well, we had a great relationship with Main Events. And Carl Moretti, who's now with Top Rank, who Anthony and I were having some great talks about, great guy. And we were going over the credential list. Now, Tyson has always been known to have a big credential list. Galata's list was probably about 2 pages long. And that's no exaggeration. And I remember Bill looking, and Bill's not one to say much, and his eyes lit up. He said, "Who the F are these people, Carl?" Well, Bill, see, this guy is there to make sure that he leaves the dressing room. And this guy's there to make sure that he does this. Well, this guy's here to check on this guy and down the list. And Mr. Garza can tell the story a little better than I. He was there too. My mind was in 100 directions. But basically, this was at least, I'll be careful the way I say this, were underworld type figures in the Polish community that were there to make sure that he got out of the dressing room and walked to the ring that night. That's how off the rocker this guy was.
Right.
I mean, he was out there. And if you saw him in the locker room before the fight, and this guy, he probably could have used Xanax or maybe some of that weed Mike was smoking, because, I mean, he was a nervous wreck. You know, he was. And I'll give credit to Mr. Garza for really maintaining order that night, because he had said something interesting to Mike before the fight in the locker room, and I'll never forget. I saw the exchange of energy, and I looked at Mr. Garza, and I didn't tell him until years later. I said, I remember this moment. And it was kind of like he got Mike's respect, and he kind of calmed Mike down. And therefore, when you saw Mike kind of headbutt him once, Mike kind of looked at Mr. Garza and was like, "Am I okay? You know, I didn't really mean it." And Mike maintained discipline. And it was Galata who got out of line. And I want to say a special thank you to my lifelong friend, Jerry Villarreal, who him and his father have got the Empire Boxing Club, who I just found out after all these years, when my legs were tangled up in the camera cord, that it was Jerry who blasted that big glass of fruit punch on Galata and splashed my suit. I was caught up with Galata going down the hallway, and I found out it was Jerry, after all these years, who I've known since I was like 12 years old, threw that drink on Galata. But Galata was off the rocker.
Absolute chaos at the palace, because everybody thought that Galata had just quit. Later on, you heard stories that his neck might have gotten broke, or there was an injury there from Tyson knocking him down. But you know what? Tyson came to fight. And that actually to say that I saw Tyson live, you know, is probably the ultimate highlight. I mean, I've seen Pacquiao live. I've seen, yeah. He came, and to me, that's
he was
that's
bobbing.
It.
He was weaving. He was in. I like to say that was really one of the last nights that he really could have put it together in the ring.
Mm-hmm.
It was towards the later years. By no means, I'm not trying to say he was in his prime, but had they made the fight with Lennox then, I think you would have at least seen him have a shot.
Right. And so let's talk some great stories here. What's your favorite memory in boxing? All these years involved in it.
You know, there's so many, but
obviously being on the undercard.
I know, exactly. Everything's downhill from here.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is all right. You can give me the check after the show. I like cash, though.
Yeah, don't drop it. It'll bounce right up and smack you in the face.
I've got a few of those. I've been around this business long enough.
I'm sure you do.
There's so many, but. This, hands down, was the greatest experience I ever had. One night, we were out in Arizona, and I was with Mike Tyson and my best friend, Daryl Francis, who was Mike's assistant for, 16 years. And Damon Bingham, whose father was Howard Bingham, Ali's lifelong mm-hmm. photographer, has said, "Hey, guys, come on. You know, we're gonna take a ride." And we ended up pulling up to this gated community, and I heard him whisper Ali residence, and I kind of, perked up in the back seat. And I was like, huh? It still didn't really dawn on me. We get to this house, open the front door, and it's Lonnie. It's Ali's wife. And she hugs Mike, hugs Daryl. I say hello, and I look down the hall, and here comes the champ. And he's coming right down the hall. And Ali starts shadow boxing, throwing punches at Mike. And Mike had this very respectful way. He would put his hands up over his face and, smiles. No champ, no champ. And here's Ali throwing punches at Mike. And my jaws just hit the floor at this point. I'm like, wow. I mean, my mind is blown. I've done some interesting stuff, but this was the coolest. And we sat, Muhammad's wife and her sister prepared an amazing meal for us that night. And we're sitting in the living room, and I'm sitting next to Mike, and then sandwiched on the other side is Muhammad Ali. Now, this is the man who was 6 years old I saw on TV, where I became fascinated with boxing. And one of my childhood heroes, Mike, sitting on the other side. And Muhammad's showing us this Elvis Presley photo book. He's not really showing us, but he's kind of showing off. And I'm kind of watching him look through it. And his voice was really bad. He was just a really faint, faint whisper later in the evening at this point in time in his life. And he whispers to Damon. Damon brings out this box, and Muhammad puts on his finger a TCB lightning bolt ring.
Oh, the taking
original,
care of business.
That's the original Elvis ring.
And taking care of business in a flash.
Yep. And I looked at Mike. I said, "Mike, look, man, the champ's showing out. He's talking shit right now, saying, 'Look at you young kids. I was the man. I'm still the man.'"
Hung out with Elvis.
Hung out with Elvis. And then we put on, Damon puts on a movie that him and Harlan had just put together of some of Ali's earlier years. It was a black and white film from overseas they did. And it was just amazing. I'm sitting there watching a film of Ali in his prime years, sitting next to the champ in his living room and sitting next to Mike. So that was the greatest night in the history of my years in boxing. And people say, "Oh, you should have millions of dollars." Just let me tell you something. You couldn't buy that experience.
Yeah.
That might be the greatest story we've had on the undercard. I mean, think about that. You were with Mike Tyson at Muhammad Ali's residence.
Yeah.
And you got to see that interchange. You spent a lot of time with Tyson, though, about 5 years, correct?
Well, I grew up a fan of his. And when he got out of prison, I said, I'm going to work on his fights. I'm going to work with him one way, shape, or form. And as I had said earlier, there's really no barrier of entry to boxing. And that's a beautiful thing. It could be a bad thing, but it can be a beautiful thing. It allowed a kid like me.
Don King proves that. I mean, you look at his track record and how he became a promoter only in boxing.
Wow. Indeed. I got some Don stories, too. But we'll stick to Mike. So I just... through connections and relationships, my friend Tariq Salmassi was managed by Sterling McPherson, who I had mentioned earlier. And I knew so many different mutual friends Mike and I shared. Our friend Mario Costa from Jersey City, Mike keeps his birds there. Matter of fact, they did that Taking on Tyson show together. Mike McCallum, Jeff Fennick, a lot of Mike's buddies, his two right and left hand men at the time, Anthony Harris and Daryl Francis, much love to both of those gentlemen, Stacy McKinley, Crocodile. There's so many people that were on Mike's team that I was friends with. I was always welcomed. The late great Zip, rest in peace, Zip, from Harlem. A lot of people always embraced me, and Mike was kind of like, who is this guy? You're like, what's he doing? So as his career wound down, my roles became bigger at times. Like Fight Night was the promoter of record for Mike when he fought Lennox. We were the promoters when he fought Etienne, along with Gary Shaw. Shelley and Bill had a great relationship, and because I had such a great relationship with all of his team, I was the perfect guy to go in and get certain things done when other people didn't want to go even on his floor of the hotel, let alone try to go to his room in the eye of the storm. So I kind of became a go-to guy. And when he had retired, I had just came back from my honeymoon, and I went out to Arizona to visit him and Daryl. And I went in the backyard. Mike was at the picnic table doing what he does, and he at the time, and he stuck out his hand. He said, "What's your angle, brother?" And I said, "Well, I don't have an angle." And he stared at me. It was like a pre-fight stare down. I stared right back at him, and he said, "All right." And he stuck out his hand. I shook his hand. He said, "All right, you're with me now." And that was it. We were cool, and I was welcomed. As I said, my best friend was his assistant for 16 years, and I kind of assisted them. I spent, you know, 4 or 5 years. It was probably the darkest years at that point. There was no more millions. There were no more fights. And it's very well documented. He was going through a very dark period in his life, battling substance abuse. And I spent a lot of time with him in California when he was getting his treatments, so when he had the court case. And it was very interesting to see him fighting really the fight of his life outside of the ropes.
Mm-hmm.
After seeing him fight as a fan for so many years inside of the ring, and
right.
to be there in that intimate company. And he ended up, I'm still friends with his ex-wife and son Amir. Shout out to Amir, nephew Amir. And he has a wonderful wife now, Kiki, and they have a great new team, and they've really turned things around, and they're doing great things. I'm really proud of them.
Yeah, it's great to see. Normally, stories like Mike Tyson don't end up good.
No.
They don't. I mean, I'll be honest. Those are the tragedies that, like, you hear about, and you know. And to say that, we saw him at the Fox Theater tell his story, and, you know, the Broadway play and everything like that. But previous to that, I had met Mike Tyson and stuff. And at that point, you could tell that he was okay with life.
You have to.
Which is amazing.
It is, and he has some great life skills. And that goes back, I always say, boxing is the greatest teacher of life skills. You know, I give seminars to clients. That's what I do a lot now, and workshops, and I help work with some private clients. And it's kind of like a strategy sessions and coaching. And I always use boxing ideologies as everything. You know, you can always rely on what our great teachers and mentors taught us. From what I was taught by Emmanuel, and a lot of the things I was so fortunate enough to learn and hear about Customato from Mike, and also Tom Patty, Mike's adopted brother. Tom's a beautiful person. And those are amazing stories. And so Mike has a great set of skills, and he worked with some great people over the years outside of the ring. A handful of them, like Daryl, Mother Marilyn, a counselor from Arizona, some great people. They were there in his corner. And then you really have to, though, you can't give enough credit to his family right now, who's been there for him, and who's they've worked together. And now I said they've got not just the personal life in order, but he's winning. You know, he's not just surviving, I mean, he's thriving. He's doing good. You know, as you said, he's got a whole new base of fans. There's a whole new generation of people that know him from The Hangover. And it's really awesome to see.
And, more people wanted the Hangover stuff signed at the Gibraltar Trade Center than they wanted
I was
the
there.
Fight
you
stuff.
Were there?
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
I drove him there.
Yeah. And,
I was sitting next to him.
Yeah,
no
and
kidding.
That's the one time he didn't show up. I would tell the story.
No, we were there.
No, he showed up on Sunday. He didn't show up on Saturday
I didn't
with
know
Emmanuel.
About that. No.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Emmanuel. That's, yeah.
Emmanuel was there
Saturday. Emmanuel wasn't there. That's right. He came the day before.
Yeah. No, and Tommy was supposed to be there Saturday. He didn't come until Sunday.
Okay.
But, yeah, we'll have to we'll talk out there about that. But
All right.
Good times and more Hangover stuff you saw going. That picture of him with Bradley Cooper went across the table more than the fight stuff, which it was a whole new generation. You're like, you know, he was a heavyweight champ of all time. He should have something there. And he was cute because he was writing whatever people wanted, you know, which
was
kind
of
fun.
Did some of the
Except
things
that- Iron. Maybe you can fill this in.
I don't know.
The one requirement, he would not sign Iron Mike Tyson. And I was curious if, like, there was a story behind it, like, because he really hated Don King. You weren't going to bring up Don King around him. And I was wondering why he wouldn't sign Iron Mike Tyson that day.
I couldn't answer. I'm not involved in his business.
You know, I was just curious if there was, like, a story behind it. Like, somebody, you know.
I know that it was told one time. It was before the Etienne fight. I remember being in the ring. And I don't know if Jimmy Lennon Jr. just flew at this off the cuff, but it was great to return to the city of Memphis, where, keep in mind, he just got his ass handed to him. He went out on his shield. Now, again, he had to give credit to this man as a fighter. At the tail end of his career, he went in there, he took his beating like a man, you know, and he went out on his shield. That was, you know, a red badge of courage almost, if you will. And to come back to Memphis, to the place where he was just handed one of the worst beatings of his career, and we sold that place out and came back, and that place erupted. We did the Jay-Z concert down the street live on Showtime simultaneous. Boom, we broke, and then came live to the Pyramid Arena. And Mike, it was very clear, you know, he wasn't going to hit the ring until Jay-Z was seated at ringside. It was a really cool promotion to be a part of. It was an electric night. And Mike, we hit the locker room, we came out, boom, Tupac drops. And, I mean, it was electric. That was probably one of the most electrical experiences I've ever had. And when he got in the ring, he dropped the towel, and he was bouncing on his toes. And I remember when Jimmy Lennon introduced Iron Mike, I remember Mike looked like he mumbled MF-er under his breath, but I just know he looked real angry. And I'm like you. I was curious.
I'm curious. I want to – you know what? If we run into him again, that's what we're asking.
I'll let you ask it.
Really?
No, I'm just joking.
Really quickly, though, Anthony Barnes has the same thing. He will not fight until I'm ringside. He waits until I take my seat, and then he hits the ring. I mean, that's his requirement. Anthony Barnes is like, I will not fight.
Leave the gun. Take the cannolis. He knows what time it is.
By the way, congratulations, because I was thinking of one of the best fight posters of all time, the Lewis Tyson, where it said, It's on. Was great because you used the two, the letters of Lewis and then Tyson is on, and that was very clever. So one of my favorite fight posters of all time.
Thank you very much. I'll bring you one of those next time if you don't have one.
You can bring anything you ever want. We got to talk about this gift really quick. You brought an original. I don't even want to unroll it anymore. It's getting too many of my fingerprints on it.
Dense.
But you got Hilmer on there, and you got Thomas Hearns. What time is this frame?
1980. They were both.
And this is original, not a reprint. That is an amazing gift.
We don't do knockoffs here.
That is an amazing gift.
But that was one of the things that that I really enjoyed doing was in all the travels. Again, you know, people always want to talk about, oh, did you make this much money? Did you do this? It was being able to talk to the fans. You know, yeah, that's cool. You know, Denzel's here. You know, so-and-so's over there. I don't even know. It's the fans. You know, it's the guy where you were sitting up top to meet you guys. And then to be able to leave a little piece behind, like give him a gym towel from maybe one of Mike's workouts in Memphis, or you give him, you know, a speed bag from a training session. Make sure that the guy got an autograph. Like, I've given away, like, all my Kronk stuff. I think I have maybe a couple shirts and a pair of shorts.
And those are hard to get now. So.
Yeah, right? And it's sitting next to this guy on my left. I mean, man, we're talking about young guys coming up today. I was shocked. I looked over. I said, oh, my God. Like, you know, I looked like a fan for a second again. I got to be careful. I said I really wasn't that much. But I like watching. He's one of my favorites. We talked about the local scene, and I'd love to hear Anthony tell us about. He's had some big stage experience. He's been with Top Rank on the big stage. He's back home. You got a fight coming up, right?
Yeah, I'll be in August.
In August, where are you fighting at?
It's going to be here somewhere again.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it's going to be in Royal Oak, Eastern Market,
Eastern
somewhere.
Market. That's cool, man. You're looking good. You had an injury for a while. What happened?
I hurt my wrist in Texas fighting on the Top Rank card.
Okay.
It was a little injured before, but I hurt it during the fight. Afterwards, had
overuse.
Surgery. Overuse.
Mm-hmm. Man, you guys.
That's a double entendre.
This guy.
If the fights are in Eastern Market, and I'm not saying I know.
He's not saying he doesn't know either.
It's probably going to be 120 degrees in there. How hot was it? And it was even a bad day.
Talk about a smoker.
I mean, it's going to be incredibly hot, and I'm excited.
That's all right. That's all right. You know, the warm up is much, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you'd be at home.
Yeah,
it's like the Kronk.
But great venue, though.
Tell them to have the weigh-ins there.
Yeah, sweat it out.
Yep.
Are you guys announcing something before you're not supposed to?
No.
All right, I don't want to get you in trouble.
No. It could be Royal Oak or anything. All I know is Carlos was very happy with the venue, and he said that I'd like to do boxing here.
It is a very good venue. They would need to change a little. If he was going to do it, my suggestion is don't use the same lighting, guys. Because I don't think boxers are going to be very happy with that. And then also they would need more speakers around, not just the one side.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting thing that you touched on. And that was one of the things that made Fight Night so different than the rest, was the aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember we went into Cobo. We did James Toney versus Saul Montana. And we went into that old dinosaur of a building. I mean, that place, I'm surprised, you know, it was standing at that point. It was very neglected. And we rented ropes, stanchion, and sheets. We darked out all of the entrance points in the hallways. We curtained off the entire top bowl. We curtained off half of the actual venue. And we actually built. This was, again, Bill was a very hands-on guy. People think, he was the promoter. Well, no, Bill, you would never see us in the ring showing off wearing our jewelry and, you know, our costume. No, Bill had a headset on and was in the hallway and was making sure that the fight was happening as it was supposed to, running the production. Now, prior to that, we were out in the garage at his house with the saw, and we were building these big platforms where the fighters came in off of the curtain. We had a DJ. We had the smoke machines, and they stood up on these high rises that we built, and they made their way into the ring. We rented small-level bleachers where we kind of put around ringside at the back. So really we brought that venue to life that night, and people forgot they were in the old Cobo Hall. And so it's interesting you say that about the lighting and
well,
the sound.
The only reason I brought up the lighting was because we just did an MMA event there this past weekend we were attending, and the lighting, they had it up on a truss. The problem was it was way too low. Yeah. Like, the guys could go like that and tap the lights.
See that shit?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow.
So if you did any jump,
we couldn't do any jumping. And then that, you know, with boxers, if you do an overhand right, if you're kind of tall a little bit, you'd smack the lights if you were in the center of the ring, if it was the same height. Yeah.
But a huge shout out to John Chalbeck
and
Carlos Lillis.
Yeah.
That was an amazing first attempt at it.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying, and that was a great experience, what worked and what didn't, and it was very well done.
Yeah,
but keep it there. Just now know that you need to do something a little bit different. So that was it. I wasn't knocking them or anything.
I'm just saying congratulations.
I would love to see a promotion like you were just talking about come back here. The only I've been fights everywhere. The only thing like now that I've ever seen close to that, or actually right about the same, that the DJs and the smoke and all that stuff, is actually in Montreal, Quebec.
With
Yvonne Michel, Gym Promotions. They do an excellent, excellent job. You know, I've never been to a fight like that before. PBC was the closest, you know, because they have like the screens and all the lights and stuff. But it's not the same when you have like Yvonne Michel, Gym Promotions. You walk out, they have the DJs, they have smoke, you're coming down the stairs, they have dancers actually up on like pedestals in the crowd. And it's a show by itself. It's
incredible. Know who was the first time I ever got to experience that coming from America? Was some of my earliest trips overseas was being at a Frank Warren promotion. And to see, like, Nigel Benn, Chris Eubank, it was like, whoa. I mean, you talk about, I mean, these guys filled up soccer stadiums. And, I mean, you could, that electricity, you could cut it with a knife, truly. I mean, those were electric venues.
Klitschko is the one that does it right now. Like
great
that.
Point, yeah, though, right. John, because let's talk about this and end it, because this is a great conversation, and I can't think of a better. We were talking UFC 200. This is going to be the biggest MMA event since UFC 1. And boxing potentially had its biggest fight of all time with Mayweather-Pacquiao. We were talking Canada, and we were talking
arguably biggest.
No, we're talking gate and second and everything. Yeah. Right, we're not talking Ali Frazier quality. We're talking gate.
Okay. Adjusted for inflation.
Yeah. In the rest of the world, ooh, boxing is number two behind what they call football soccer.
Yeah.
Mm. In America, we're a niche sport boxing. We're fifth. We're behind the four majors. If ESPN gives us a shout out. So what you're talking about with Adonis Stevenson and everything that's going on in Montreal, those are passionate fans. They're chanting. They're absolute going nuts.
Diehard fans.
What he's talking about with Europe still exists. I remember Ricky Hatton watching those fights and just hearing the chanting.
I have so many fans in England that I've met from Ricky Hatton fights, and they come over every single time. They spend thousands of dollars just to see him. Rather, if he got knocked out or if he won, doesn't matter who he fought, they were there.
So I guess the closing conversation would be, John, do you think boxing can ever become a mainstream sport?
Well, mainstream, I don't think that we're ever going to see our love sport go back to the front page of the papers without buying that space, because you have to look at the power that's behind the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball. And I want to say, because those are organizations, okay? Boxing is the wild, wild west still, okay? And I threw an extra wild in there for a reason, okay? And the PBC, okay, now is a great time to talk about it. They set out to kind of corner the market and do that. Well, what are they? I don't know. I've heard various reports, a couple hundred million in the red. I don't think that's a success. So no, I don't think it will. But I also want to say this: boxing isn't going anywhere.
Mm-mm.
Okay, MMA has impacted it to a degree, but everybody always likes to talk about this. Oh, boxing's dying. This is the fight to save boxing. Boxing doesn't need saving. That's a marketing gimmick. No, these fights are to resurrect and save the business of boxing. Mm-hmm. Mayweather versus De La Hoya was not the fight to save boxing. It was the fight to give a shot in the arm to those promotional entities. Okay, that's a way to sell tickets. That's all that is. And so the fans have to understand that. And I don't want to take away from pay-per-view subscriptions by saying that, but we didn't need Pacquiao Mayweather to be shoved down our throats with propaganda and charge $99 or whatever it was. I didn't buy it.
I think it was like $99.
I wouldn't pay that for it.
And this is coming from a guy that's been in the business a long time. I asked him out in the hallway, John, would you get back in it? Your answer was flat no.
No, I have no interest to be a promoter anymore. You've got some good guys around here that are doing a good job at it. And that was interesting to hear John getting involved in it. I had a discussion with him briefly one time. Nice young man. And I love his style. He brings
fights
it
anyone.
That's it. Comes right forward, brings it. My only thing to him was I said I'd love to see him focus on doing one thing. I know he's got to keep food on the table, but that's another big difference between our generation and the new generation. These guys can train, they can do other things. Our guys, they would take the bus to the gym, their lights were getting shut off. I remember I went K-9. A lot of guys living in rough circumstances, but that's what they did.
I got a great story about John Chalbeck, and I can say it now. So here we go.
All right.
So John, we sponsor John because he's a fighter, just like we sponsor Barnes over there. And he broke his hand in the boxing match.
Yeah. He told me that.
And we were the first, I think, first people he told. And he basically said, but don't tell anybody because I got a fight in 2 weeks and I don't want the commission to say no. And because he knew that, what I do, the commission knows. And I was like, that's a fighter right there. I mean, most people will duck behind an injury, but he's like, don't tell anybody.
Yeah.
Look at my hand. And I'm still going to fight.
And what happened? He won within the first minute of the first round with a rear naked choke.
Right. And I talked to him after the fight, and I said, did the broken hand affect you? And he goes, yes, I punched the guy. I went backhand like that, and it hurt.
Yeah.
And he goes, I got to win by choke.
Right, exactly.
That's what he did.
And that's exactly what happened. He came out. He smacked him.
He relaxed his hand.
He saw him, like, recoil his hand back, and I knew something was wrong. I mean, I didn't know that he had broken his hand, but I knew something was wrong. He pulled his hand back, and then immediately went for the shoot, went down, like, 15 seconds later, got on, I believe he got on his back and rear naked choke, and that was the end of it.
Be careful. You know, a lot of people don't realize, again, dear friend of mine, who was really played a big role in my life in boxing and outside, was Jeff Fennec. And it was one of my earlier camps as well. And a lot of people don't know, Jeff had to fight pretty much his entire career with getting injections because his hands were so bad, they were so brittle. And the last time he fought for the title, he got one too many injections, probably a couple too many. And he was walking on clouds when he went out to the ring against Philip Holliday. And it broke my heart because I was a kid. I actually cried when he lost. But he lost. It wasn't because Philip Holliday was the better fighter. Jeff was ferocious. He still is ferocious. That's one guy you don't want to meet in a dark alley, Jeff Fennec. And he'll give you the shirt off his back, though. I love him dearly. But he had so many injections that he was on cloud nine. Couldn't even fight.
Well, we want to thank so much, John Lepak. You can catch his stuff, too. How often do you write for UCNLive.com?
I owe him about 2 months' worth of work.
Okay.
But I'm going to get busy now since I'm here.
If you've enjoyed anything that John has said, and since he reached out to the show, and I greatly appreciate this. This is one of the best reach-outs of all the time.
I love what you guys do. It's guys like you that keep things rolling here.
He reached out to us. It's been great conversation back and forth. I love hearing these stories. Here's a guy that knew Emmanuel, lived with Emmanuel, right?
Lived
with Emmanuel. Yeah. And, Mike Tyson, great stories. So we want to thank you so much for joining us. Well, do you have, like, a Twitter or anywhere else someone can follow you, or are you just on UC?
I mean, it's on there. I think it's lightning_JL, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
All right. Look him up on Twitter.
I'm old school.
Now, this is as much boxing talk as Marv and Jimmy can handle without it bloating. So we were going to allow them.
I was listening.
I'm just playing. Yeah. But we were going to allow them to quiz Ring Girl Cassie here on some things that are going on currently in the country or in the world.
It wasn't even necessarily a quiz. There was a specific thing we wanted to know if you knew about, and then we were going to talk about and something that specifically happened with it. Have you heard the term Brexit?
Negative.
Okay. I'll spell it out just in case you may have seen it as a hashtag, all right? Brexit.
No.
Okay. Would you eat one?
With you asking me that? No.
Okay.
She knows you.
So Brexit was this big landmark vote in the United Kingdom to remove themselves from the European Union. Okay. Now, I know that's very political. So basically what it means is that the United Kingdom voted – the majority of the people in the United Kingdom voted to remove themselves from the European Union, which means that all of the immigration, all of the trade, all the stuff that they had to follow because of the European Union, they no longer have to follow because they voted to leave the Union. Okay? Now, as everybody knows, okay, do you know who are the two front runners for the presidential race in the United States?
I believe so.
Okay, who are they?
Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Okay, that is correct. All right. So Donald Trump decided to go to Scotland, okay? Now, Donald Trump is not the sharpest tool in the shed. And when he got there and landed in Scotland...
He is a tool, though.
He is a tool.
Oh, no,
he's just not, he's not the sharpest tool.
He is a tool.
When he landed in Scotland... Everybody was kind of, you know, whatever. And he thought it was because they were so happy that they voted to leave the union. However, However, Scotland voted the majority of the people in Scotland voted to stay in the Union. Okay, and when Donald Trump said this, Scotland basically jumped on Twitter and basically lambasted him. And there is a show we're gonna play a little clip, and then I'm gonna read some of the other things. There is a show called There's nobody behind us.
Like 3 minutes.
There's nobody behind us.
Well.
Yeah. Anyway, so we're going
to
play
this.
This
interests
clip.
Me, and I'm already bored.
Scotland overwhelmingly voted to stay. I mean, who's afraid of immigrants?
This is Samantha Bee, by the way.
Right. Full frontal with Samantha Bee.
The poor Scots woke up Friday morning to find that the English had fucked them yet again, just like they've been doing ever since Scotland's blue period. How could the day get any worse for them?
I think it's a great thing.
It's a great thing.
It's going to be great. No, I think it's
a fantastic thing.
I think it's a fantastic thing.
Ugh, I can't decide which of those loud windbags is more painful to listen to.
That is the best line ever uttered.
I agree.
You'd think that sound might clue Trump in about.
All right, we're
going to
jump ahead a little bit. So David Tennant, who is a Scotsman, she basically has him read most of the Twitter things that people have said.
Twitter things are called tweets.
Tweets. Sorry.
With pleasure. They voted remain, you wiggy slice. Scotland voted remain, you weapons-grade plum. They voted remain, and they hate your guts, you ludicrous tangerine ball bag. Scotland voted to stay, you numpty. Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay in Europe, you two-paid fuck trumpet. Scotland voted to stay, you witless fucking cocksplat.
Thank you, David. That was so
All right, those words,
fuck trumpet.
Those were
the best insult.
Yeah, those weren't some of the worst ones and some of the funniest ones. There's one that says Scotland. It's a diagram of Scotland and all the colors saying who voted to leave. And Scotland's all in yellow, which means that they did not vote to leave. And Scotland was more yellow than your fake tan. Let's see. Another one was Scotland voted to remain, you tit. Scotland voted Felicity. Plug ears. Okay. Scotland voted overwhelmingly to stay in Europe, you two-paid fuck trumpet.
He said that one. That was my favorite.
Oh, did he? Okay. Yeah. Scotland voted to overwhelmingly to stay in the EU, you weasel-headed fuck nugget. You're such a gobshite. Scotland voted to remain in the EU. You utter and complete Egypt. Landslide vote to remain from Scotland. UK vote only just managed to force us to leave. And Egypt is a Scot and Irish word for idiot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. There was another one. But there was another great one, which I can't find it right now. But basically, Donald Trump in his, he is basically double downing on his already double down idiocy, said that... it was something about he was leaving Scotland and going to the UK.
Yeah,
he was leaving Scotland and going to England, but he said, "I'm leaving Scotland and going to the UK."
Had a great time in Scotland. Looking forward to visiting the UK.
Right, which
Scotland is in.
Scotland
the UK.
Is part of the UK. Scotland no. is
that would be like being in Pennsylvania and being like, "We had a great time in Pennsylvania. We'll see you in the United States."
Right, exactly. So that, people, ladies and gentlemen, is just
is your front runner.
One of your front runners for president.
I kind of think of this, and I don't have a dog in the fight because I'm not a fan of either candidate. But I kind of think of this as like the Dukakis moment where he wore like the helmet and the tank, and then like all of a sudden like it was bad to not know that Scotland like this.
You know what?
This is going to haunt your campaign.
You know what though? Is like he has pulled so much of this crap and floated past. I really don't – I don't think it will any worse than any of the other ones will. No.
Yeah,
The people who support him
probably
had
also,
no idea
no.
that Scotland – they had no idea Scotland was part of the UK.
I'm sure the people that support him didn't even know Scotland was a real country.
The people that support
him probably thought it was a fictional country from Braveheart.
Right.
Yeah. Ireland.
All right. We got to wrap this up. Once again, we want to thank John Lepek. For joining us, thank you so much for the poster. We want to thank our ring girl, Cassie, for joining in. Anthony Barnes for stopping in. Happy birthday, buddy.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week, and we're going to break down. It's going to be a whole show to UFC 200, but what a great boxing night. Share it with your friends, this podcast. John knows his stuff. I'm sure John will be on our show again. I'm going to say it right now.
With Anthony, I want to hear him talk.
All right. Well, he's normally on the show more. He got all Hollywood on us.
Maybe you could pick Anthony up and drive him here in a car that
if I can drive.
No, I've been having to work and stuff. You know, I have to like pay for that Cadillac.
So. All right, we'll talk to everybody in
Thank
a week.
You very kindly.
You're listening to a previously recorded episode of The Undercard, Hand Combat Radio.